he was restless, and when she gave him a corn cake from her store, he paused in his chewing to listen. He was uneasy and nervous. He glanced over his shoulder. He lifted the big knife and felt its edge. When Coyotito gurgled on the ground, Kino said, "Keep him quiet." "What is the matter?" Juana asked. "I don't know." He listened again, an animal light in his eyes. He stood up then, silently, and crouched low. He threaded his way through the brush toward the road. But he did not step into the road. He crept into the cover of a thorny tree and peered out along the way he had come. And then he saw them moving along. His body stiffened, and he drew down his head and peeked out from under a fallen branch. In the distance, he could see three figures, two on foot and one on horseback. But he knew what they were, and a chill of fear went through him. Even in the distance, he could see the ground. Here, one would pause and look at the earth, while the other joined him. They were the trackers. They could follow the trail of a bighorn sheep in the Stone Mountains. They were as sensitive as hounds. Here, he and Juana might have stepped out of the wheel rut, and these people from the inland, these hunters, could follow, could read a broken straw or a little tumbled pile of dust. Behind them, on a horse, was a dark man, his nose covered with a blanket, and across his saddle a rifle gleamed in the sun. Kino lay as rigid as the tree limb. He barely breathed, and his eyes went to the place where he had swept out the track. Even the sweeping might be a message to the trackers. He knew these inland hunters. In a country where there was little game, they managed to live because of their ability to hunt. And they were hunting him. They scuttled over the ground like animals and found a sign and crouched over it while the horsemen waited. The trackers whined a little, like excited dogs on a warming trail. Kino slowly drew his big knife to his hand and made it ready. He knew what he must do. If the trackers found the swept place, he must leap for the horseman, kill him quickly, and take the rifle. That was his only chance in the world. And as the three drew nearer on the road, Kino dug little pits with his sandaled toes so that he could leap without warning, so that his feet would not slip. He had only a little vision under the fallen limb. Now Juana, back in her hidden place, heard the pad of the horse's hooves, and Coyotito gurgled. She took him up quickly and put him under her shawl and gave him her breast, and he was silent. When the trackers came near, Kino could see only their legs and only the legs of the horse from under the fallen branch. He saw the dark, horny feet of the men and their ragged white clothes, and he heard the creak of leather of the saddle and the clink of spurs. The trackers stopped at the swept place and studied it, and the horseman stopped. The horse flung his head up against the bit, and the bit roller clicked under his tongue, and the horse snorted. Then the dark trackers turned and studied the horse and watched his ears. Kino was not breathing, but his back arched a little, and the muscles of his arms and legs stood out with tension, and a line of sweat formed on his upper lip. For a long moment the trackers bent over the road, and then they moved on slowly, studying the ground ahead of them, and the horsemen moved after them. The trackers scuttled along, stopping, looking, and hurrying on. They would be back, Kino knew. They would be circling and searching, peeping, stooping, and they would come back sooner or later to his covered track. He slid backward and did not bother to cover his tracks. He could not. Too many little signs were there, too many broken twigs and scuffed places and displaced stones. And there was a panic in Kino now, a panic of flight. The trackers would find his trail. He knew it. There was no escape. Except in flight. He edged away from the road and went quickly and silently to the hidden place where Juana was. She looked up at him in question. "Trackers," he said. "Come." And then a helplessness and a hopelessness swept over him, and his face went black and his eyes were sad. "Perhaps I should let them take me." Instantly, Juana was on her feet, and her hand lay on his arm. "You have the pearl," she cried hoarsely. "Do you think they would take you back alive to say they had stolen it?" His hand strayed limply to the place where the pearl was hidden under his clothes. "They will find it," he said weakly. "Come," she said. "Come." And when he did not respond, "Do you think they would let me live? Do you think they would let the little one here live?" Her goading struck into his brain. His lips snarled and his eyes were fierce again. "Come," he said. "We will go into the mountains. Maybe we can lose them in the mountains." Frantically, he gathered the gourds and the little bags that were their property. Kino carried a bundle in his left hand, but the big knife swung free in his right hand. He parted the brush for Juana, and they hurried to the west, toward the high stone mountains. They trotted quickly through the tangle of the undergrowth. This was panic flight. Kino did not try to conceal his passage as he trotted, kicking the stones, knocking the telltale leaves from the little trees. The high sun streamed down on the dry, creaking earth, so that even the vegetation ticked in protest. But ahead were the naked granite mountains, rising out of erosion rubble and standing monolithic against the sky. And Kino ran for the high place, as nearly all animals do when they are pursued.